Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a day of stark contrasts between Ivanka Trump and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin gleefully announcing the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, while a few miles away Palestinian protesters were being shot down by Israeli snipers, with more than 52 killed and 2,400 wounded. Dr. Guy Ziv, a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israeli National Security Project and author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, joins us to discuss Prime Minister Netanyahu's soaring popularity in Israel, where he is seen as having got Trump to tear up Obama's Iran deal and move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. We'll look into whether today's carnage could be topped by massive demonstrations planned for Tuesday, the day which Palestinians observe as the Nakba, the catastrophe, when in the 1948 war Palestinians fled or were driven out of their homes. And we'll assess whether the U.S. has extracted any concessions from Israel in exchange for handing Netanyahu such massive political gifts, and if there is any hope of reviving the two-state solution and the so-called peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. Then we will examine the staggering hypocrisy of the overtly Christian Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who has just shut down the Department of Education's investigative unit looking into the rampant abuses by the for-profit colleges, who are subsidized by the taxpayer to rip students off with meaningless education and worthless diplomas, indenturing them for life with crippling student debt they will never be able to pay off because they will never get the jobs they were promised. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was a special assistant for national security affairs for President Clinton and a counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to assess why Betsy DeVos has no problem with ruining the lives of young Americans who, instead of being seen as investments in the country's future, are seen as profit centers to be milked by Wall Street vultures and bottom-feeding scammers. Then finally, we will speak with Einat Lev, a volcanologist and research professor at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, whose research focuses on lava flow dynamics at different volcanoes around the world, including Hawaii. We will discuss her article at CNN, Why Hawaii's Volcano is in Danger of Going Ballistic, and whether, while the focus is on fissure-spewing lava on Kilauea's East Rift Zone, Kilauea Summit Crater, where the lava lake is dropping precipitously, is about to explode, as it did back in 1924, sending giant 8-ton rocks into the air the size of 4 pickup trucks. And joining us now is Dr. Guy Ziv, a professor at American University School of International Service and the director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Guy Ziv.
Thank you.
So the hawks are in ascendancy in Israel. Netanyahu is more popular than ever. Most Israelis think he's responsible for Trump pulling out of the JCPOA, the P5 plus 1 deal with Iran, and the movement, obviously, of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem has been hugely popular in Israel. So what's your sense of whether or not there's any quid pro quo here? Did the Americans get anything out of this deal? They gave everything to Israel. What did they get in exchange?
Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree with the premise that they gave everything to Israel, simply because I don't think that any of this serves Israel's interests, nor do I think it serves U.S. interests. So I'm going to start from that premise. I think that Netanyahu has kind of a set of objectives that he has been very fortunate to be able to meet, and it's definitely useful for him to have President Trump kind of navigate this. But I don't think that President Trump really understands the nuances. I don't think that he has studied up on the Iran deal, on the U.S. embassy move. So much of what he does is driven by political symbolism that does not necessarily enhance U.S. Strategic interests.
Well, but you're making the distinction between Israel and Netanyahu, and I think it's a valid distinction. but Netanyahu's taking Israel in a certain direction that you have indicated you think is against Israel's interests. It's worth noting that there was a big split between Netanyahu and his security experts in the intelligence services, Mossad and military intelligence. They kept saying that the Iran deal is actually good for Israel, but Netanyahu nevertheless went ahead and pushed and urged Trump to get out of it, and now they're celebrating the fact. So what is the current situation in Israel? Is there still a recognition amongst the military and the intelligence people that tearing up this deal is a bad idea?
Yes, well, I think you phrased it pretty well. There's kind of a gap between what the politicians are saying and what the security establishment is saying, which is not to say that the security establishment was united behind the Iran deal. There was kind of a range of perspectives. But once the Iran deal was reached, there was a near consensus that it should remain intact because it's better than the alternative. And part of the problem is that there is no alternative that's been outlined by this administration or by Netanyahu for that matter. So I think at this point, yes, you have a split between Netanyahu, who's clearly happy about Trump's decision to pull away from the agreement, and the members of the security establishment who are very wary of the repercussions, because Iran is now going to be much closer to a breakout than it was than it would have been had we stayed in the deal. And that, of course, assumes that Iran is even going to stay in the deal, which is far from clear.
So what did you think about what's happening today in Israel, Dr. Guy Zivin? Obviously, it's going to get more intense in terms of demonstrations and deaths as the Palestinians observe the Nakba, as they call it, the catastrophe. Yeah. The founding of the State of Israel. There was obviously great celebration yesterday in Israel on Foundation Day, but then you'll see the reverse, if you will, coming from the Palestinians. And today, I don't know what the death toll is as we speak, but it's up past 50, with 2,400 Palestinian demonstrators wounded just in today so far. So it's a stark contrast, is it not, to Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, and Ivanka Trump pulling back the curtain on the seal of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and all the celebrations, with, of course, Jared Kushner saying, where there is peace in this region, we will look back upon this day and we'll remember that the journey to peace started with a strong America recognizing the truth. I don't know what the truth he's referring to is. Do you have any idea?
Look, I think the administration has been saying from day one that they're committed to the peace process. That President Trump says he wants the ultimate deal. Jared Kushner is supposedly the point person to help realize this deal. But there's no question in my mind that the events we're seeing unfold today with the opening of the embassy, the relocation, its symbolism, and the kind of the spirit that we see among the Palestinians contradicts the objective of realizing a two-state solution. And so, again, I kind of want to stress the emphasis on political symbolism for this administration and for the Netanyahu government, for that matter, as opposed to pursuing, U.S. strategic interests. There's a reason that every administration since Bill Clinton has issued the presidential waiver every 6 months, not because they didn't want to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but because they understood that East Jerusalem is expected to be a capital of a future Palestinian state, and they did not want to prejudice the outcome of the final status negotiations. So I think today would have been a much more joyous occasion if it were done in the context of a final status agreement.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Guy Ziv, who's professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. So that takes us back, Guy, to my original question, though. Did the U.S. get anything out of this major concession to Netanyahu?
It's far from clear whether it had. I think part of what drives President Trump, and part of what drove him to do this, is domestic politics. So I don't see it purely in terms of his relationship with Netanyahu or with Israel. I see it also in terms of his dealings with the Christian right in the United States, because it was the Christian right, after all, that really pushed him to move the embassy. It was very, very important to leaders of the evangelical community. And I think that that should not be lost in the conversation. So there's definitely a domestic political gain, perhaps, for the president.
Right, but what shouldn't be lost in that context is an understanding of why the Christian right have this affection for Israel, the so-called Christian Zionists. Israel is the trigger for the end of the world, according to their rather, I think, spiritual pornographic interpretation of the book of Revelation. So the Israelis essentially, I think something like only 144,000 Israelis get raptured up in the Great Rapture, but the rest of us, me and perhaps you too, we all end up in the lake of fire. So it's a horrible, horrible idea, isn't it, to support Israel in the hope that they will begin World War III and Armageddon?
Well, I won't disagree with you. I just don't have much to add to that.
Well, let's then focus on the minister. I think it supports what you're saying, that there's a domestic component here in the United States to what's going on in Jerusalem today. The Southern Baptist minister who gave the invocation in the opening of the embassy, Mitt Romney, has condemned him as a bigot. He has said that the Mormons are heretics. He's made anti-Semitic remarks as well, and he's also said that Catholics are the work of Satan. So an odd choice, would you not say, for a representative of American Christendom?
Yes, and you have two. I don't know if you mentioned this, but you have two pastors who have made very controversial and in the past even anti-Semitic statements. So it is very interesting, ironic, that they were the invited guests at the embassy. Also very interesting that no Democrat was invited, not even the former ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, who happens to be in Israel at this time. He wasn't invited. No Obama administration official was invited. No Democrat. And so this also raises the question of, is this administration aiming to completely turn this issue into a partisan football game? Because that seems to be what's happening. And that started not with Trump, but with Netanyahu several years ago. As you may recall, he, you know, addressed a joint session of Congress when he tried to thwart the Iran deal.
Right, and it could go back further. When he showed up during the Clinton administration, and the night before he met with Clinton, he went to a rally with Jerry Falwell, one of the leaders of the Christian Zionist movement here in the United States.
That's exactly right. No, it does go way back to his very first term. You're absolutely right.
Right. So is there any possibility that something is going to happen inside of Israel? We started out by mentioning how Netanyahu's popularity is soaring. Israelis feel that he's responsible for pushing Trump into breaking the deal with Iran, and they're giving him credit for the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem. What does this mean? I mean, it's obvious when you see the support for Likud here in the U.S. from some of these right-wing big donors to Trump, like Sheldon Adelson, and obviously we understand that. It's a bit of a paradox because, as far as I know, two-thirds to three-quarters of American Jewry actually vote Democratic, and you mentioned there's no Democrats invited to the opening. So what's your sense of, is there any written in the past about not giving up on the two-state solution? At this point, it's pretty hard to have any kind of enthusiasm for peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, in spite of what Jared Kushner says. And there's also... Go ahead. And it's also, I was going to say, there's also not much sense that the Israeli left is going to make a comeback politically.
Not at this point. I think this is a short-term gain for Netanyahu for the reasons you outlined. I think the real question is what's going to happen after, you know, what's going to happen after this dies down, assuming it will die down and not turn into another intifada, which is, by the way, far from clear at this point if it is going to die down. But assuming it does, then the question is, what's next? What do you do with, the Gaza Strip, which is essentially an open-air prison where people are in dire straits? What do you do with the Palestinian Authority, which has a leader who's been in power now for 12 years, 13 years out of he's still in his 12th or 13th year of his first term. He is ill. He's old. He's unpopular. I don't think we're going to see a two-state solution during the Trump-Netanyahu-Abbas era. I think this will have to happen later. The question is, how many more lives will be lost between now and then? At the end of the day, there has to be a two-state solution because it's the only viable solution. It's the only way that Palestinians will have their legitimate rights while Israel's security needs can be met. And it's truly tragic that that hasn't happened yet and that there is no move in that direction.
Well, just in the last few minutes, guys, since you direct the Israel National Security Project at American University and you closely follow national security issues within Israel, a while back, apparently, the U.S. set up a secret permanent military base in the Negev Desert, an air defense base. But my understanding is that more recently, they've set up another secret base on the Golan Heights that may well have something to do with signals intelligence and looking, picking up stuff inside of Syria where there's an ongoing war. What do you think's happening there? There's been an exchange of rockets between the Iranians and the Israelis striking Iranian targets in Syria. And also Netanyahu himself has spent quite a bit of time just in the last few days with Putin. He was there for 8 hours. I think he had very long meetings with Putin. They seem to get on. Russia and Israel, even though they're in pretty close quarters in the same war zone, whatever their deconfliction is, it seems to work. But it's almost like the Russians are giving Israel a free hand to pound the Iranians. So what do you think's going on?
So here I think there actually is a rather clear objective on Netanyahu's part, which is to prevent the Iranians from creating a permanent foothold in Syria, which they have been trying to do. And here is where I think the security establishment is more or less in line with Netanyahu on this. So this is not so much a right-wing or left-wing or hawkish or dovish issue. It's seen as in the national security interests of Israel to prevent the Iranians from having that permanent military presence in Syria, and Israel will do whatever it can to prevent that from happening. Now we're not talking about regime change. So it's not about toppling Assad, even though every once in a while you'll come across a voice here and there from a cabinet minister or a Knesset member who will hint or suggest it. But as far as I know, that's definitely not the policy. And you're absolutely right about the communication and rapport that Netanyahu has established with Putin. Probably a smart move, but I would not read too much into it. At the end of the day, Putin is not going to give up, Russian interests. And that, according to Putin, is ensuring Assad's continued rule in Syria. I also would not assume that the Russians would be okay with any Israeli military operation, especially not one that would result in Russian deaths. So I think that's something that Israelis are probably quite sensitive to as well. So long as Russian soldiers are not put in harm's way, Putin may look the other way. But, accidents can happen. And so this is why it becomes a very, very risky gamble in a sense.
But just in closing, in the broader sense, though, there's a lot of concern that pulling out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal with Iran, is a move away from diplomacy towards war. And there's a lot of speculation now that there might well be another war in the Gulf. There's no question that Netanyahu's adopted a very hawkish attitude to Iran, as has MBS, the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia. And John Bolton is considered quite hawkish on it as well. It's difficult to know where Pompeo comes down and where General Mattis comes down. He's the one person that a lot of people sort of turn to in the hope that he's the adult in the room, but we simply don't know. But on Netanyahu's side, though, just trying to analyze what he's up to, is he trying to get the Americans to fight a war for him against Iran, or is he just using Iran as a bogeyman? Because the more you focus on Iran, the less you have to focus on the Palestinian issue, which is something that they don't have a leg to stand on. It's, in other words, it's the politics of distraction, just as Donald Trump employs the politics of distraction here on a daily basis in the United States.
Yeah, I don't think Netanyahu is itching for a war. That would be a huge risk, and if there's one thing he's not, is it's a risk taker. He tends to be risk averse. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that the situation can't spiral out of control, that accidents may happen or misunderstandings or misinterpretations, and before you know it, there is a regional war, and I think that's the real danger. But I don't think that it's in anyone's interest at this point to have a war there. Also, keep in mind that Iran may decide to use one of its proxies should it decide to retaliate against Israel. It can use Hezbollah, which is much stronger now and a much stronger position today than it's ever been, in part because of the experience they've had in fighting for Assad's regime in Syria, and in part because of Iranian financial and logistical support. So I think that there are a lot of dangers there, and hopefully we won't see a war. And the one, I think, perhaps silver lining here is that the fact that Netanyahu has established kind of a modus vivendi with some of the moderate Sunni Arab regimes could bode well for regional talks and subduing the tensions. But there's a lot of work to do on that front.
But on the question of, is Netanyahu using the Iranian bogeyman on the international stage as a way of avoiding having to deal with the Palestinian issue?
I think he's more focused on the Iranian issue than he is on the Palestinian issue. You know, I don't know if he's using Iran as a bogeyman. I think he's genuinely concerned about Iran and its strategic hold in the region. I also don't think he is very focused on the Palestinian issue, and there isn't, frankly, a lot of pressure on him to do much on the Palestinian front. So I'm not sure he really needs Iran to divert attention from that.
Sure.
I think it's something he actually believes in.
Right, and he's certainly not getting any pressure on the Palestinian front from the Americans.
No, he's not getting it from the Americans, and he's not getting it domestically, and even the Europeans are not doing all that much to pressure him. So I don't think he's doing – I don't think he's focusing on Iran to divert attention from the Palestinian issue. He's really – nobody's pressuring him to do so.
Well, Dr. Gaziev, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Guy Zip. He's a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres, and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the staggering hypocrisy of the overtly Christian Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who is quite happy to see students ripped off with crippling student debt. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org And joining us now, David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor to Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian.
And we've spoken, I guess, over the years now about the for-profit college racket, where something like $40 billion of taxpayer money is given over to these for-profit colleges who, by and large, in fact, I think by certainly the majority of them, essentially give these kids a worthless diploma and get them indebted for life with huge and unsustainable student debt, which limits their possibilities to get a job, to get a home, to get married, to buy a car, to, et cetera. So it's having a detrimental impact on the entire economy, and we essentially are indenturing the next generation. And our Secretary of Education, a good Christian woman, Betsy DeVos, has now decided to get rid of the unit within the Department of Education investigating fraud at for-profit colleges. So why would a good Christian want America's kids to be indentured for life and conned into taking on debt to end up with a worthless diploma, which will never do them any good in terms of getting a job?
Why does the Trump administration exist? Greed. So Betsy DeVos may be a religious woman, I don't know, but she's certainly connected to and is hired as her aides a bunch of people that work in the for-profit education field. And that field has been about emphasizing profits over the welfare of students. And as you say, it's led to terrible outcomes, as much as $32 billion a year, billion, going to this sector, and bad outcomes for students, the high loan default rates, often worthless educations, worthless degrees, high dropout rates, but also bad results even if you graduate. And all the research is showing students are worse off enrolling in these schools. They're better off not going to college at all. They do worse than high school dropouts. And we came close to realizing the magnitude of the problem at the end of the Obama administration, finally doing things like, as you said, creating an enforcement unit in the Department of Education. But that is one of many reforms created at the end of the Obama administration that Betsy DeVos is now getting rid of.
So what else has she done in terms of enabling these vulture capitalists and predators who are indenturing our young?
Well, as I said, she's brought into her department people like Robert Itell and Diane Jones, people who work for some of the worst for-profit schools, companies like Career Education Corporation and Bridgepoint Education. She took two regulations that were very hotly contested at the end of the Obama administration. One says if your program at a for-profit or career school consistently leaves students with debt they cannot afford to repay, then you may lose your federal eligibility for federal student grants and loans. That was called the Gainful Employment Rule. Then there is the Borrower Defense Rule that basically put some teeth into a statute that had always said if you went to a school that ripped you off, then maybe you have a chance to ask that your federal loans be forgiven. Both of those rules I watched in slow motion being dismantled at the department. They're required to have these meetings, these rulemaking meetings where stakeholders sit around the table, and the department came up with the most draconian rules for students and the least accountability for the schools. And this is what Betsy DeVos's department is doing to unwind those rules. They got rid of the enforcement unit. They are granting, the other thing they're doing that is just an absolute disgrace is they are granting applications of former for-profit schools to convert to nonprofit status, meaning they're freed of the few remaining restrictions that apply only to for-profit schools. They can now be not subject to taxation anymore. And best of all for them, they can now brag, as they're doing, that they're nonprofit, freeing themselves of the stigma of that they created through their bad behavior. Unfortunately, they've structured these deals, whether it's Kaplan or EDMC, which runs the art institutes, or Grand Canyon, or now proposed by Bridgepoint, they structure a deal where the former owners of the nonprofit, for-profit, can keep getting rich off the nonprofit. It's a nonprofit in name only. In every other way, they're continuing the scam. And DeVos is approving these conversions.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So is this just simply a case of if you're appointed by a president who ran his own fake university, which he had to settle on, and by the way, had to settle with Schneiderman, who is now disgraced. Is this yet another example of the fish rotting from the head?
Well, it is and it isn't. I think President Trump couldn't care less. His whole career has been about being a con man. So I think he very much would enjoy this nation of Trump universities that has sprouted up all around the country. And in fact, he'd be jealous, whereas Trump University was bringing in only tens of millions. One of these schools alone, University of Phoenix, got $4 billion in a single year from taxpayers. So I think if President Trump really had time to focus on this, he would love it. But even without President Trump, the Republican Party, for whatever reason, which used to frown on waste, fraud, and abuse with taxpayer dollars, now doesn't mind it if they can take a cut. And so all over Capitol Hill, people in the Republican leadership, Virginia Fox, who's the chair of the House Committee that deals with education, and many other Republicans have been for a decade or more on the payroll getting campaign contributions from these for-profit schools. Think tanks, Republican conservative think tanks get money, and publications, conservative publications, are paid to validate this orgy of waste, fraud, and abuse with taxpayer dollars. And to take one more example, the for-profit college industry's chief lobbyist, his former staffer was named Calista Bissick while she was working for him. His name's Steve Gunderson, former congressman from Wisconsin. While she was working for him, Congressman Gunderson, Calista Bissick met the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, and they became Mr. and Mrs. Gingrich. And now Mrs. Gingrich is the ambassador to the Vatican. Mr. Gingrich is a lobbyist working for the for-profit college trade association run by Mr. Gunderson. So he, a Trump crony, has been in there lobbying for the industry. Meanwhile, the revolving door is working, and a lot of former Department of Education aides during the Bush administration left to seek their fortunes working for for-profit colleges. And now they've burrowed back in to the DeVos department to help her dismantle all the regulations that were constraining the for-profit college industry and its partner in crime, the student loan industry, which has been trying to and succeeding under DeVos to free itself from restrictions such as the Obama administration said if a student defaulted and 2 days later or was delinquent on payment and 2 days later paid back, can the industry sock them with thousands of dollars worth of penalties? The Obama administration said no. The industry cried foul. Now the cronies of the industry have burrowed back into the department, and they've gotten rid of that rule. So everything they're doing is to the advantage of these sharks, these sharp operators who are trying to make money off taxpayers. And, of course, there is a lot of money to be made in education. But the shame of it is if they took the $30 billion a year and just threw it in the river, that would be better than giving it to these crooks, because these crooks are motivated to use the money to sign up as many students as they can, and every one of those students has the potential to have their life ruined. Some of these students have a worthless degree or no degree, and they owe as much as $120,000, or they owe $20,000, which is too much for them to pay back anyway, especially because they got nothing out of it. They're back at their job at Home Depot or Walmart because the education that was promised them to become a video game designer, a chef, or other things, it didn't pan out. And even if it did, their starting salary in that job is not close to what would be needed to pay back the loans for programs that can cost as much as Harvard, but without the payback.
And out of this $32 billion a year, the University of Phoenix got over $4 billion of taxpayer money. I mean, they not only do they get taxpayer money, that's how they make their money. This is a form of kind of right-wing welfare. They also use a lot of that money to advertise, because you see University of Phoenix advertising all the time on TV. That's how they get these kids in. But I was reading about a guy who was working so many jobs, trying to keep his head above water, living in his car, and he was just a sort of footnote in the article was that he's paying off his student loans from the University of Phoenix.
University of Phoenix has a football stadium named after them. They don't have a football team, but that's where the NFL team in Phoenix plays, at the University of Phoenix Stadium. They spend most of their money on advertising and executive salaries. They spend, you know, a for-profit college can cost a student 10 times as much as a community college for the same program, and then spend one-tenth as much on education as some comparable programs at state schools. So it's absolutely, the money is going to just not only the crooked schools, but the crooked lead generators online that have fake websites that lure low-income students. They have websites that say, come here if you want a job. They don't actually have any jobs. They just have a portal for you to input your information. Then you'll get 10 calls a day from recruiters for for-profit colleges. So all of that money goes into, yes, recruiting, and then what they can squeeze out of it goes into profits, and very little is spent on education. And the idea that having realized that this scam had happened, that the Trump administration would come in and reverse it all, blatantly allowing this form of corruption and waste, fraud, and abuse to return is just amazing, the lack of accountability of this government. You see it in other areas, too, in other departments, but this department is one of the worst because of the horrible impact on individuals that's being caused by the scam that the government is sanctioning.
So just broadening it out, though, in the last few minutes here, David Halpern, the $32 billion a year scam with the for-profit colleges, all subsidized entirely by taxpayers, ruining the lives of countless kids, a lot of minority kids aspiring to join the middle class, along with vets who are also being fleeced. And then you've got the Betsy DeVos, the good Christian woman, who doesn't seem to mind kids' lives being ruined by these racketeers on taxpayer money. Then you've got the charter school lobby, which is getting huge. I mean, the charter school lobby here in Los Angeles are backing Villaraigosa for governor. I mean, it's shameless. They put up a ton of money. So it looks as if Wall Street's figured out there's a lot of money to be extracted out of education in the most predatory, vulture-like way. So is this what's happened to this country? Instead of our students becoming centers of investment, they're now seen as centers of profit?
They're commodities to be bought, and their debt is then bought and sold. And that's exactly right. We should be investing in students, and we should be investing in schools. I don't care if they're for-profit or non-profit, but we need to put performance standards on things that we spend our money on and that we send our students to. And that's the idea that conservatives who are supposed to believe in small government, or, you know, religious people who are supposed to believe in charity and in doing good deeds, would allow this to happen, as you say. They're not just kids, of course, you know. A lot of these are adults. They're single moms. They're people of color. They're immigrants, and they're veterans, and they're military spouses, military families, active duty service members. These are all the people that President Trump said I was going to help. Remember, he said he would help the inner cities. He would help the forgotten man and woman. He would help our veterans. These are the exact people that these for-profit schools that the government is giving money to, these are the people that Betsy DeVos and the for-profit schools and the Trump administration are all working together right now to screw and to make their lives basically a living hell. I know these people, and they call me, and they're trying to decide between doing the right thing, you know, with that they think legally they're obligated to do, is pay back student loans for worthless education, or pay for food, or pay for rent, or pay for diapers for their children. And it's just an absolute disgrace that these fat cats, these billionaires like Trump and DeVos, and all these private equity people and Wall Street people are getting rich off this. And when they got caught, as I said, they, instead of repenting or shutting it down, they're now back to celebrating this orgy of waste, fraud, and abuse. And we have to fight back and take our government back from people like this.
Well, just in closing, the New York Times has a front page story about this today, but you have been onto this story for a long time. What, short of voting in November, can people do?
People ought to first of all work on public information campaigns. Put it on your social media. When you hear about these schools that are a scam, visit my website, republicreport.org, where we report on these scams and also list all the schools that are under law enforcement investigation. When you're thinking about where to go to school, take a very good look, because you can do much better at a community college most of the time than to go to one of these for-profit schools. You also should be writing to Virginia Fox and to members, your member of Congress, and say, oppose the PROSPER Act. PROSPER, capital letters, PROSPER Act. God knows what it stands for. But it basically means try to rewrite all the federal laws to favor for-profit educational institutions. I don't think the PROSPER Act will pass, but the message ought to go to Congress that people are paying attention, and especially if you're a veteran or somebody who is, you know, deserves a better chance to tell the Congress that this is just a way to ratify these kind of rip-off colleges and the abuses of students that have been going on.
And, of course, Virginia Fox is a corrupt, ignorant hillbilly from North Carolina.
Well, I like North Carolina, but I will say that Virginia Fox did one of the most outrageous things in the history of this sordid tale, which was to compare opponents of for-profit colleges to the Nazis. She said, first they came for the for-profits, and I was silent. You know that trope.
Yeah,
so,
so
she's a disgrace, yes.
I thank you for joining us, David Halperin.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a volcanologist on the likelihood that the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii is about to explode, sending 8-ton rocks into the air the size of 4 pickup trucks.
Teach your parents well, the children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why.
John's room, your father, be there with her. Your feet.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Einat Lev, who is a volcanologist and assistant research professor at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Her research, funded by the National Science Foundation, is focused on lava flow dynamics at different volcanoes, including in Hawaii. And she has an article at CNN, Why Hawaii's Volcano is in Danger of Going Ballistic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Einat Lev.
Thank you.
And while most of the focus in the press is on these fissures and Kilauea's East Rift Zone, where houses are being evacuated and roads are being covered in lava, and we've seen the pictures of spewing lava mixed in with the tropical trees, etc. But apparently the real issue might well be the lava lake at Kilauea's main crater, where I've been there. It's quite spectacular. It's a massive crater, and there's the Volcano House Hotel right there on the lip of the crater. So Tell me, what do you expect to happen? Because the level of in not the big one, but the smaller lava lake apparently has dropped precipitously, and that's indicative of the possibility that you could have a repeat of what happened in 1924.
Yes, that is correct. What you just said is that the lava lake has dropped in level as the pressure inside the volcano has reduced. We see the entire volcano deflating, and as the lava is going out on the East Rift Zone, the lava lake is drained, and the risk right now is that now that the lava column that used to fill up that lake isn't there anymore, it's not there to hold out the groundwater. So if the lake drops below the level of the local groundwater table, then water might seep into the conduit and start interacting with the rocks and the lava, and then you get steam, and high-pressure steam can lead to an explosion.
And apparently the level of in the lava lake has dropped precipitously. It's measurable, is it not?
Oh, yeah, it has measured. It has dropped to about, I think, more than 250 meters. So that's almost 800 feet below the level that it was at the lip of the lake. So that was the maximum. Remember, just a couple of weeks ago, it was so full that it was actually overflowing when the pressure was so high, it was holding the lake up high, and the lava was spilling on the floor of the crater.
Well, when it happened back in 1924, where you had a similar steam-driven explosion, apparently the rocks that were thrown up were weighed as much as 8 tons, which is about the size of 4 pickup trucks.
All right.
And one person was killed, apparently hit by one of these rocks. But so what kind of precautions are they taking now in terms of the possibility of history repeating itself?
I'm actually not sure what the limitations are in terms of visitors to the national park. I know that the USGS and the local authorities are walking all the time to make sure everybody is safe. They probably evacuated some of the summit area, mostly because even without an explosion, this area has now a very high level of toxic gases. So I'm not entirely sure what the access limitations are, but I'm sure there are limitations right now.
And I mentioned the Volcano House. There's also, isn't there a research facility there as well on the lip of the...
Yeah, so right on the lip of that crater, besides the hotel, there's also the observatory, the Hawaii Volcano Observatory that belongs to the U.S. Geological Survey. And they monitor the volcano, and it's their job. So it's difficult sometimes for them to do their job right now with this high risk that everybody's facing. And next to that is the Jaipur Museum, which documents the volcano and the national park, and it's the headquarters for the Hawaii Volcano National Park. So there's quite a bit of, and there's like 2 million people visiting it every year, and many of them want to go see the summit.
So at this point, the concerns seem to be mostly about getting away from the sulfur dioxide, is it not, the gas. And I believe that if you breathe that in and it mixes with moisture in your lungs, that forms sulfuric acid, does it not?
That is correct. And sulfur that is being emitted either as S2O, sulfur dioxide, or as other forms of sulfates from volcanoes, they can also interact with moisture in the air and produce acid rain. And also the particulates can create VOG, or volcanic smog, which is hazardous to plants and to human health. It's a skin irritant. So overall, a high level of sulfur dioxide is not good for any part of the body or the environment.
So what's your sense then of where this, I don't know how you rate the sort of danger of volcanoes, because here on the West Coast, I'm talking to you from Los Angeles, but on the West Coast we have Mount St. Helens, we have Mount Rainier in Washington,
right.
Mount Hood in Oregon, and Mount Shasta, and others as well. Not too far from us, of course, we have also in an earthquake zone. Is Kilauea the most active in, it's obviously a part of America being Hawaii, but in terms of, is there a difference between active volcanoes and ones that are likely to explode, as happened with Mount St. Helens? Because I don't think anybody was anticipating that, was they?
They could definitely tell Mount St. Helens was about to erupt or was active, but it's very difficult with any sort of eruption or even more with earthquakes to say, to pinpoint exactly the time and day it will. With Kilauea, you know quite reliably that it will do something because it's almost always doing something, but it's sometimes hard to know how long it would last, each episode, or where exactly it would go. So, I mean, it's been erupting for a long time, but as long as the lava was not going towards the community, it wasn't such a big deal. And now that it is, then there's a lot of attention to it. Because it's a fairly lightly populated island, and it's not like the volcanoes in Alaska, it's not interrupting with any major flight routes, then the hazard from Hawaii doesn't translate to a big disaster potential.
So what's the relationship between these fissures opening, the 18th of which opened on Sunday, and the main lava lake? Is that what's causing the lake to drop? And then when it drops to the level of the groundwater level, then you have the potential for an explosion because of the steam that's generated as the lava interacts with the groundwater.
Right, right. You had it just right. The entire plumbing system, all the tubes and channels and pockets underneath the volcano are connected. So when one of them drains, it can reduce the pressure in other parts of the volcano.
So then, if this is happening, if there's an 18th fissure that just opened, presumably there can be more that would open, and then that would accelerate the process of the lava lake dropping. So would that indicate that a major explosion is all but inevitable?
It depends, because it really balances the forces. If it reduced just enough so that all the excess pressure is now released and the fissures are stopping, then maybe not. But it's definitely likely. And also, there might be smaller explosions from the lake triggered by rocks falling in from the edge that is not just by the groundwater interaction.
And what's going to be shot up into the air? Is that going to be a toxic plumes?
It's going to be what was filling out the lava lake before, as well as materials from the sides of the conduit or the vent area. So it's going to be older rocks that most of them lost a lot of the gases. But it's still going to be a lot of ash and dust and pebbles and rocks of different sizes.
So, but it's not going to be like the explosion in Iceland that causes the volcanic ash to go way up into the jet stream.
It might. It reached the jet stream in 1924, but it reached sort of the lower levels of it, so ash went as far as 10 or 12 miles. If it gets to the higher parts of the jet stream, then it can go further. That said, Hawaii is in the middle of the ocean. It's not like Iceland, that Europe is right next door.
Right. But are there different kinds of volcanic explosions and different kinds of effects?
Yeah, so the volcanoes in Iceland have been quiet for, the one that you mentioned has been quiet for a long time. It was also covered with a thick layer of ice. So that all contributed to a much bigger, more ashy explosion back in when it happened. But this volcano here is probably not be as big a plume, but it could still be bigger than what we've seen in 100 years.
And then, so why was Mount St. Helens then so devastating? What was different about that?
Mount St. Helens and similar volcanoes on the West Coast and in Alaska, typically the magma's include much more what we call volatiles. So that would be gases such as water, CO2, that are inside the magma when it's deep inside the crust, and then they get released in bubbles. And that's what's causing the big pressure. And also the type of magma that we get on these volcanoes has a higher viscosity, so it's like stickier, and it's able to build a big pressure excess. So then when it does fail, you get a bigger boom.
So it's like removing a cork from a bottle, is that what it is? Except it's like the ultimate exploding champagne bottle, I guess.
Right. So if you have kind of a fresh bottle of Coke with a lot of gas in it, then it would be a big explosion. But if it's already Coke that doesn't have so much gas, it's like half flat, then it would be a smaller explosion.
So how do people like you, volcanologists, predict these conditions? You have all kinds of instruments around these active volcanoes, I take it.
Yeah. So there's a huge range of instruments that we can use to indicate what's going on inside a volcano before and during and after an eruption. Some of them are on the ground, like seismometers that look for earthquakes, cameras that look for changes in the lake level, or temperature meters. We also have things that look at tilt. Is the ground sloping more or less? So is the volcano inflating or deflating? And then there's satellite records that show changes on the ground and gas and temperature changes.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Anat Lev, what's your sense you must have some fascination. I mean, just going to Kilauea, it's extraordinary. I mean, it really is. You're looking down into the bowels of the earth, and it's awesome. And, it's just it's like earthquakes. You know, we have them out here. I actually like them. I mean, I don't like the damage they do, but it sort of reminds me of humans aren't quite as important as they think they are.
It is true. It's fascinating, and I study lava flows. I think they're beautiful and so primordial, and I really obviously don't like the damage that they do, but when they stay away from people, they're gorgeous. But it is true that it really reminds us that we're so little, and there's little we can do about it.
And that's pretty much the way the Hawaiians see it, right? Is it the god? The god's called Pele, right?
Yes.
And what's the mythology of Pele?
So she created the islands and she controls the volcanoes. And if she wants the lava or the volcano to do something, that's what's going to happen.
So you don't want to mess with Pele?
No.
Get on her wrong side.
Right.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. And
sure, you're welcome.
And as I say, you're pretty sure something's going to happen.
It seems likely.
Yeah. Well, Anat Lev, again, I thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I'm speaking with Anat Lev, who's a volcanologist and research professor at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Her research is funded by the National Science Foundation, and it focuses on lava flow dynamics at different volcanoes, including in Hawaii. And she has an article at CNN, Why Hawaii's Volcano is in Danger of Going Ballistic. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.